Hi, and welcome to the Homefront Girl podcast. I'm Gabby Jurgens, and I am the creator of the Homefront Girl brand line of products and designs. I started my studio because I wanted to give a voice through my designs to the families that stand with our men and women in uniform, the silent ranks, as we are sometimes known. I want this podcast to be filled with the stories and voices of what I have come to call the other half of the brave, from the creative world of Hollywood and celebrities who have created and supported the stories of our life, and to you, those on the home front, who also serve. I also want to introduce you to some inspiring women who, if not from the military world, they will inspire you by their stories of going for their dreams, despite the obstacles and the challenges that they found. Something we know about in the male spouse world. So, get ready and saddle up, as they say in the Army. This will be fun. Thanks for joining me. And as always, thank you for your service. Hello, everyone. I want to welcome to Homefront Girl, the podcast. Joining me today, I'm truly honored and overjoyed to have with me Jonathan Younger, who is co-president of Millennium Media, the movie company that brought us the film, The Outpost. It's an extraordinary film that is now the number one film in America. Congratulations on that. Jonathan also was co-producer on the film as well and played the role in the film of Sergeant First Class, Jonathan Hill. I am also joined by Army First Lieutenant, retired Hank Hughes. Is it Hank or Henry? Are you retired or not?
I'm retired. My last rank was actually a captain, but you can call me. I was a lieutenant during that time period, so I understand that. And I didn't retire. I just did 5 years and got out.
Well, thank you for your service, Captain Hughes. Thank you very much for your family's service as well. And you served at Outpost Keating, didn't you?
Yeah, that's right. I did. Yeah, in 2007 and 8.
Okay. Yeah. And you helped to retell the story of what happened there. And you also co-produced the film. And by the way, as I said, you're also a filmmaker with some, congratulations in the past on your short story Oscar nomination, and future success to you on all that you continue to do. Again, I want to thank you both for coming on the podcast, and I want to congratulate you on this extraordinary film. The audience that is listening to you right now is an audience of families. When I created Homefront Girl, its inception was the studio was to really focus on the families. I grew up in the military. I never saw reflected in the retail arena the sacrifice and the inspiration of the men and women and families and children who are behind the camo and the boots. And so basically, I grew up in this life. So I was an Army brat, and I understand, Hank, you did as well. So you're a fellow Army brat. So we'll do the secret handshake later, you know.
Absolutely, count me in.
So I have to say, I grew up watching war films with my dad. I was a World War II film buff. I still am. I have been very fortunate to meet and to do a lot of things with the Greatest Generation and our World War II veterans and Normandy. And I used to, as an Army brat, I used to hang out at the motor pool. So, you know, I was really an inquisitive brat, actually. And my mother despaired. I think she thought I was going to end up in the boots, and I didn't. And if you know me now, you'll know that I can't even take an order to save my life. But I did overhear on occasions the ribbing and, of course, the very colorful language that I can only call soldier speak. And I have to tell you that this film, it nails it. It absolutely nails it. Because as you, as I started watching the movie and the way the guys just treated each other, the ribbing, the joking, the don't call home, and Henry, I think you'd probably agree. I mean, you live this life, you're a soldier. It's part of it, isn't it? There's this language that you guys speak that I think comes from being a part of this brotherhood, if you want to call it that, sisterhood. And I was just taken by that because that immediately grabbed me from the beginning when I started watching this film, is how much that just sort of peppered the entire beginning. I think it's the first film in a long time that really immerses you almost immediately into the lives of these soldiers, and you want to get to know them, and also the camaraderie that does exist between soldiers. And I know that director Rod Lurie served in the military, West Point, class of 84. And I think he did an extraordinary job with this film as well. So for a little bit of a background on the film, for those of you who have not watched the film, and shame on you, you should run out, because I have been doing my level best all over social media to get you to go watch it. The Outpost was written by Jake Tapper, and it came out in 2012 about combat outpost Keating and the Battle of Kamdash. This was the bloodiest battle of the war in Afghanistan. 54 soldiers against an onslaught of about, was it 300 or 400 Taliban?
The numbers sort of vary. It's hard thing to sort of count exactly how many, but I would say, yeah, maybe like 300 plus or minus 100. It's probably accurate.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. 54 against that. The unit was Bravo, 3rd Squadron, 61st Cav. Am I right?
Yeah, 361 Cav.
Yeah. And it became the most decorated unit of the war. Out of this war, we have two living Medal of Honor recipients, Staff Sergeant Romache and Specialist Ty Michael Carter. I think, didn't they gain rank afterwards? Because I wasn't sure if I had the correct rank.
They both did. Right? Ty Carter stayed in for a few more years. I believe he got out as an E6. And okay. Romish stuck around for a little while as well. Although the last I really know about what he was doing, I guess, was in that the interview that Jake Tapper did. And I believe he was doing some work in oil fields, I believe, somewhere. But I believe he got out. But they both stayed in for a little while longer.
After that. Okay. And then I do have to mention Caleb Landry Jones' performance was incredible as Carter. I mean, I don't know. I'm not going to jinx you guys, but I see Oscars all over the place. So I'm just going to tell you that right now. But
I won't. Would it be Hank's first time?
Okay. Okay. So, Jonathan, my first question goes to you. Okay. As co-president of Millennium Media, you know, you're a filmmaker. You've done like 50 films that you've worked on. What drew you to making this film? And when did it first come to your attention? When did you first hear about it?
It was about 7 or 8 years ago. I thought it'd be really great to do an American hero story, to try to find a true story about, our servicemen and women. And I started looking into different battles, and I looked into Operation Steel Curtain, which was one of the first forces to go into Iraq. And things like that. And then I just couldn't find something. And then one day I was just on YouTube, and I went down a YouTube hole, and I saw...
Easily done.
Yeah, always.
Always.
I saw Romache on David Letterman when he was on, because Letterman brings on some, Medal of Honor recipients onto the show. And so I just clicked on it and I watched it, and he was talking about, Romache was talking about the battle, but then he talked about this lull in the battle, and that when you kind of just, where everyone's kind of just chilling out for a second. Uh-huh. But when that happens is your adrenaline starts to come up, starts to subside, and you start to realize, oh, I'm hurt here. You start to feel the pain after in the middle of a gunfight, once the adrenaline starts to come down, you start to feel where you're hurt, right? Then he also realized how thirsty he was. He was so thirsty. He said that he found, which was his favorite soft drink, but he found this like piss warm Dr. Pepper.
Oh God.
And he like, it was like shook up, and he opened it, it was like, he drank it. And he would look for his cigarettes. He had like a Camel Light or something. And he just turned to David Letterman, and he said something like, that was the best damn Dr. Pepper, best damn drink I had. And the way he said that, and just watching, I was like, oh my God, this is a movie. And so I started to look into the story. And then the way we eventually ended up having it, because we had it and lost it and had it and lost it so many times that I was going insane, because it was so important to tell this story. And I didn't want anyone else to tell it. but my team. Yeah. And it was just crazy. And that was about 7 or 8 years ago.
Did you read the book by Jake?
I didn't know that the book had existed until later. And then I read the book. But by the time I already read the book, I had been chasing and trying to make this movie. And I didn't know that there was another movie being set up at Sony, which is the Clint's Red Platoon. And there was a script being written for based on Jake's book, which is the one that we ended up with. And I only found out about that because my partner at Millennium, Jeffrey Greenstein, him and I, we used to have the same boxing coach. And the boxing coach, who's a guy named Mark Smith, he connected Jeffrey with Paul Tamasi, who's the writer, and said, "You guys should meet each other. You might have some stuff to talk about." I was out of town, so I didn't go to that lunch, but Jeffrey called me later that day. He goes, "Dude, guess what Paul Tamasi is working on?" And the way he said, I was like, "The Outpost." He's like, "Wow. Hey, John, like, it's the only thing I care about. So that's why you're probably calling." And so we would go and push and push and push to get it. And they didn't want to do it. They keep saying, Millennium, let me tell you something. They didn't want to do the movie with us. They didn't trust us in the beginning. Now, they're like, Millennium this, you guys do Hitman's Bodyguard. I get it. I understand.
But, we do a lot of action films. So, I'm a fan of The Fallen. So I'm a real big fan of that. Yeah, so.
I love those. But this was different. You know, absolutely. This was a true story. They have to be very sensitive here. I understood that. And but we have a reputation in town, which hopefully I think under mine and Jeffrey's tutelage is starting to change. But so then they didn't want to, we were like the last stop in town for them when they finally came in. But after they had hired Rod, and they were like, "Does anybody want to do this movie?" And they're like, "Well, Millennium says they want to do it." And Rod's like, "Why aren't we there?" And they're like, "Eh." And we went in, and then you know, the rest is history.
Wow.
Especially, yeah, it was crazy.
But it sounds like you were destined.
Paul Merriman, I cornered him on a balcony. I cornered Paulie Merriman on a balcony in Toronto. Hank, you don't know this. When we were talking about it, because that's when he was working with Sam Raimi at the time. Remember when Sam Raimi was working at Universal? I got like this close to his face, and I was like, "Yo, we need to make this movie. Do you not understand what I'm telling you right now?" And like, I was like, it just became, and that's how Paul and I got close.
That's amazing. I mean, that's extraordinary.
And then we needed to bring on, and then Hank, we brought Hank on because we had met him. Hank, when did we meet?
Because I went to AFI and so did Paul Merriman, the American Film Institute. And so we had a link there, but actually I met him through Jake Tapper because I was in the book, because I was in the unit that preceded, or one of the units that preceded 361. And so I think he linked us up around the time that I made that short film that was doing really well. And I think that's how we all got. I read some early drafts of the script when I was still with Sam Raimi and so on. And then once they linked up with y'all at Millennium, then that's when I met Rod. And then I think I met you after.
Oh yeah, that's right. You came in. We were so impressed with Hank when he was talking about, first of all, we had seen Day One. His film that was nominated.
Yeah, it's absolutely.
It's such a beautiful movie. And then he came in and we were just so impressed with this guy. We're like, this guy is our dude, you know? And he was so weird. We even offered Hank a huge movie, but he turned us down.
Wow, Hank, that's something.
We'll get a lot of offers. That's not true.
No, but we'll work together. I'm looking forward to working with him again.
Well, I think that's the great part of the creative world is that opportunity. But it definitely sounds like it was meant to be for you, Jonathan, that this film was just going to land in your lap. I mean, it went a very long journey, but it got to where it needed to be. So, you know, and Hank, you being in it, having served, as you said, your unit preceded the unit that was in this battle. What division were you with? What were you attached? Because I really actually, because I am such a freaking military brat, I can actually look at the entire film and I'm looking at patches and I'm looking at, okay, is this a third ID that they were with? I mean, so what unit were you with?
I was in the 173rd Brigade Airborne Combat Team.
Out of Vicenza?
Sort of. I was in 191 Cav. And so we were actually in Germany. They're now all, I think, in Vicenza.
Yeah.
I mean, I went down there a few times, great place, but I spent most of my time up in Schweinfurt, Germany. Yeah. And I was in Bulldog Troop. And yeah, we were there at Camp Heating in 07, 08. So we were the second people there. I want to say the 10th Mountain was there right before us.
We were with the division, the 10th Mountain, and I have friends who actually commanded at 170 in Vicenza with the 173rd. But you know, what was it like for you when you arrived at Camp Keating and you saw the location?
Yeah. I
mean, what were your thoughts as a soldier?
Totally. So I met my unit in country. I finished Ranger School and I spent Thanksgiving with my mom and dad, and then I flew over there. And so I didn't know anybody. And it was strange because I was on the helicopter with my commander. He happened to be flying back as well. So I met him, and then we fly into this valley, and it's the middle of winter. I mean, you can see it's just everything is covered in snow. It looks like the Alps, except where they go on forever. And we're riding, you know, sort of like through above the river and in the valleys, and all of a sudden you just descend, and it just kept getting lower and lower and lower and lower until we're like finally at the river, and you jump out, and I mean, it's immediately, you're looking up and you're like, I cannot believe that they put a base at the bottom of a valley.
Yeah.
And not just like at the bottom of a hill, but a bottom of like three mountains. It's like where a river forked. And so you can imagine three rivers, three mountains. And so it's just like a completely upside down idea of where it is you want to be in terms of a defense or tactically or such. But it was a different kind of war where we were trying to, you know, engage with the local population to promote the government of Afghanistan and try and provide security for the people. And so it became a matter of human terrain versus the traditional sense of key terrain. And that's how we got there, at the bottom of a mountain in a really indefensible position.
Did they have a lot of those outposts like that during that time in other places?
For sure. I mean, there were a ton of small little remote places like that. I mean, you might've heard of Wanat, a ranch house. What was the other one called? Bar Ilam? No, that's not Bar Ilam. It's something else. I can't remember the other name. Anyhow, it was like this idea that we would just go out in these kind of like small company size or sometimes even platoon size combat outposts and engage better with the locals. The problem is that it was very hard to like, you spend a lot of time just trying to make sure you could survive there in a way that wasn't conducive necessarily to the overall mission. It took a lot to
Absolutely. I mean, when I looked at it, when that flyover, that opening scene, and they're coming in at night, and you know, Roman Shay, Scott Eastwood, my God, what a great a great performance by him. And boy, does he look like his dad when he was younger. It's scary. You know, it's like you all, it's, you're sitting ducks, basically. I mean, whoever, it's just insane. And I know following, and I read the credits and all of that, you know, they re-looked at it and said, okay, that was a stupid idea that we all came up with once again. And they did away with them and they bombed them to oblivion. But I mean, it just doesn't make sense that they would have put anyone in that position. I mean, I understand about engaging the locals, and I don't know, whose line was it that said, we want to gain their hearts and minds and they want our blood and guts?
Oh, that was Keating.
Yeah.
We got to gain their hearts and minds. And then Caleb or Carter, he said, they want our hearts and minds. We want their hearts and minds. They want our blood and guts. Yeah. And that was in LMTV.
Okay. So, Hank, so when you went back to Camp Keating as an actor, okay. Yeah. And you went back. I'm kind of interested, you know, when you strapped on the boots and the camo and, you know, you're a soldier again, and now you're on a movie set, but you're back in the midst of, you know, I mean, it must have been, what did it feel like for you? I mean, you were assigned there. So now you're back and you're playing a role. Back with soldiers.
I suppose the, I won't give you one word answer, but if I had to, I would say surreal. It was like walking onto a memory. It's a place that no longer exists. It's a place I probably will never see again. Not unless for some reason I get on a motorcycle and really risk it and figure out how to get all the way up to Kamdesh in Nuristan, Afghanistan.
That's an insanity. Don't do that, please. You have many things to contribute to the world. Don't go and do that.
Give it like 20 years. I think I might. It will be amazing to see if that's possible. But, you know, I mean, I always think about these Vietnam vets and they get to go back. And I would love to be able to do that at some point. That was like, you know, I wasn't supposed to be able to see any of that stuff ever again. And Eric Carlson, who was the production designer, did such a fantastic job of trying to bring it back to its, just bring a sense of realism in it. I mean, it was sort of shocking. I remember we started walking on set and I realized like, oh man, I'm about to have a real emotional moment here. And so I went into my old barracks, which is one of the ones that they outfitted. It's in the movie. But this one was Red Platoon Barracks. And yeah, I just basically sat on my bunk and what is a movie version of my old bunk, and had a good little cry, and then went back out there and looked around, and it just felt very personal, probably. And I'd say that the sort of best part of that would be that my mom ended up coming to set. You know, I'm not supposed to be an actor. I write and direct. And Rod asked me to be in the movie, and I feel very special that he asked, and I don't want to turn, I want to accept challenges. And so I did. But so my mom came out and to show her that space, that, you know, it's a place I spent a year of my life in, a very formative year. It was my first tour, you know. I never thought my mom would ever see that place. So to show her the closest version of that, you know, without, you know, I'm not taking my mom on that motorcycle trip I mentioned.
No, I don't think I would do that. Yeah. So that would not be good. Yeah. You will not get a present for Christmas, I'm sure, if you did that. But I will say that I can see the emotion of what something like that would be like, and similar to, I think, like you said, Vietnam veterans go back to Vietnam. We don't have a lot of them, but the Greatest Generation and the D-Day veterans go back, if they can, to Normandy and to Europe and to try to revisit. And I think it's true. It's because it's at such a point in your life where, you know, you're so young. I mean, when I saw the credits roll and I saw the ages, I mean, really, it was impactful to see the actors and then to see the actual photographs of the men who died and their ages. It's, you know, it's amazing. It's gut-wrenching. Now, Jonathan, I have to say, you did an amazing job and you seemed born to play the role of a soldier. So what kind of preparation did you go through for the role of Hill?
Well, I started my career as an actor, so I took it on like any other acting role. Running and gunning was something that I knew how to do, but it was getting into the embodiment of an American soldier.
Yeah.
And what was cool is I had been spending a lot of time, you know, with Hank and with Jericho and with Ray and Travis, and, you know, they kind of kept the soldier authenticity. You know, Jericho, Ray, Travis, they were our technical advisors. Obviously, Hank is one of our producers, and they were all in the Army. And Hank, obviously, being at Cop Keating, and Daniel being surrounded by Dan Rodriguez. The truth is, those guys were there. So you had to bring it. Even as an actor, you had to bring it. I mean, you had Jericho right there, who can be scary sometimes. So you had to do the best that you possibly can. Even though technically I was their boss, I was scared of them. Yeah, but as an actor, and then I also spent time, what I wanted to do, and also just making this film, is make sure how authentic everything was. And that when the Gold Star families would watch this movie, that they would be happy with what they saw. I guess happy maybe is the wrong word, because you're watching your son.
Yeah, that's pretty harrowing.
But just that it would be something that they approved of, something that was therapeutic for them, hopefully. Mm-hmm. And And so I told Rod, I really want to talk to John Hill, and he connected me with him. And I would call John Hill every other day. And him and I, we got pretty close. He's a great guy. He's a really nice guy. This is actually a photo of him and I when we met in person for the first time.
Is that him?
Yeah, that's John Hill. He grew a beard. I can't grow a beard that long yet because I don't think I finished puberty.
But, that's funny. Wow. Yeah, looks like ZZ Top, actually. He's like going for ZZ Top look.
he's such a great guy. He really is. And getting into him, I would actually talk to him and just learn about him. You know, the lullaby that I sang in the song, when we did the phone calls, that was the actual lullaby that John would sing to his daughter every week.
Yeah, those sack phone calls that you guys made and you listen, especially, I think the one that I cracked up a lot was the guy smoking, saying, "No, honey, I quit." And he's like, keeps drawing on a cigarette.
Was playing Kirk, yeah. But so that's just what it is. You get into it. And then as an acting thing, and it had been a while since I've acted, but just, you know, act well your part, come prepared. And pray that we're doing things right by the families.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I certainly think that you honored those soldiers and their families with what you did. And I think one of the things about this film is that it was so engaging and so emotionally. And one of the things that I loved about this film, honestly, is that it was apolitical. There was no, it was service and sacrifice. It wasn't politicized as it so often might be in real life, and we hear about it. But this told the story of, you know, all these men they put everything on the line, and it was about the soldier. So it wasn't about any war. And I really appreciated that. And I think the families appreciate that.
The interesting part is when we had our first test screening, we wanted to see if people thought that it would be political. And there was a question for the test screening in the questionnaire, and 0% of people thought the movie was political. So you're right by saying that, Gab, it actually really is apolitical, and it was tested and proven to be apolitical in a test screening. And that was what we were setting out to do, because I think that the movies that have come out, and I'm not knocking any of them, I think they're all great films, but like American Sniper and Lone Survivor, mm-hmm. or 13 Hours, or any of the true stories that have come out, it's always been about the special forces. Mm-hmm. It's always been about the SEALs. It's been about Delta Force, the elite of the elite of our armed forces. And,
right.
But these were the guys at Cop Keating were the grunts. Exactly. Normal dudes, people that people could relate to. And it's kind of like Ty Carter says, like, we're just normal guys, regular guys. They all have child support to pay, trying to kick a drug problem. The issues that people deal with every single day, they were there. And I think the moral of it is, after being in this for so long and talking to these people, is that I think everybody has some hero in them. Just if you're put in the right circumstances and you can rise to the occasion, obviously, if you have your brothers and you. But I think that hopefully watch the film, and people that weren't involved in the military, that they understand that it's possible for everybody to have that in them. That even if you're just a normal person off the street, that you have that potential as well. And I hope that they can empower people.
Absolutely. You know, the tagline when I was coming up with Homefront Girl in the studio, I basically, my agent asked me, you know, well, so, all right, so give me a tagline. What's it about? And I said, well, it's a mom, it's a son, it's an aunt, it's an uncle, it's, you know, it's anyone who has ever loved someone who served in our military and shared that hero with the world. And that's essentially it. I have lived this life my whole life, and we served jointly. You know, like Hank, I'm sure, you know, you've got the memories of growing up in this life and what it was like. And I always say when I'm doing an interview or someone's asking me about, our men and women who serve, and I use the term hero quite a bit. And I always say to them, I said, look, I have yet to encounter one man or woman who wear our country's uniform who has ever called themselves a hero. But the men and the families, the loved ones who are home, we consider them our heroes. And so we call them that. And, you know, that's part, I think, what you really nailed in this film is that these are regular, as you call them, grunts. And that's the truth. We've had lots of films that portray some of our most elite units. But, you know, I think the scene where Caleb Landry Jacobs, and I had never seen him in a film before, but I've got to tell you, I'm one of his biggest fans right now. But when he played Specialist Carter, and the way it was just so gut-wrenching, and, you know, he's kind of made fun of a little bit. You know, he was a former Marine. He got kicked out. Then he comes into the Army. I mean, he's a little gangly. You know, there's this part about him, but boy, who would have ever, you know, you see them when the battle then comes. I mean, he's running back and forth. I mean, I'm like on the edge of my seat saying, oh my God, he's going to die, you know, but he has this extraordinary just desire to, you know, what the warrior ethos that Hank knows very well, it's you never leave anyone behind. And he truly, especially that emotional moment when Mace doesn't make it, it just, his eyes are just incredible. I've got to tell you. And again, I think that credits your photography, you know, the director of photography and your director. I mean, the way this film just grabs you is just, it's amazing. It really, really is. And I've talked to a lot of military families who have since seen the film, former soldiers, former brigade commanders, former grunts, and their families. And I really, to a person, what I got back from them, because I really wanted to know what they thought before I came on and talked to both of you. And they felt that this film itself, I mean, I don't see it as an action film. I see it as an emotional war film, because you made us really get invested in these soldiers' lives before the battle came on. And by the time the battle happened, you're so completely invested in their lives and, you know, how this is all going to turn out. And I think with anything, when you have a public that's invested emotionally, I mean, I don't think you can lose with that. And you guys did that in spades. So, you know, kudos to all of you. So I do have kind of something funny. Okay, I want to know, what was the funniest thing that happened on set? Were there any pranks? Any, you know, it's known, you know, if you're on a set, usually you've got a prankster. Or what was funny? What did you, what about you, Jonathan?
I'm trying to think of one. I normally do them all the time. But on this one, it was kind of, I feel like I pranked Rod with something, with telling him that we had something and we didn't have something. But I forgot. I'm trying, hey, did you do any pranks?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember if there are any pranks or not. I can tell you a cool story is that when I was at Outpost Keating in real life, we had a dog named Callie who lived there, and she like lived through a bunch of the units that were there. And on this movie, when we made it, I actually found a dog that was a stray there and like ended up taking her home. And like my mom now has, so we named her Callie after that same dog. Aww. And she had four puppies that then went out to a bunch of our other friends, because I guess she was actually pregnant when we found her. And so when I think about funny things, like I had a dog randomly, just like I had a dog in Afghanistan. There was a stray, like.
And hey, is that not weird?
Stayed longer, right? Didn't you have to stay longer because you had to?
Yeah, I ended up staying. I had to go to Germany with this dog because she gave birth like 2 days before I was supposed to leave Bulgaria in a hotel with my mom. We were like seeing Bulgaria.
No one knew she was pregnant.
No idea. Yeah, I came to the vet like five times. They didn't even know. And so we called up some of our German friends because, you know, they live outside Garmisch because the military. And so I was like, hey, I need to stay at your house with these dogs. And they weren't there at the time. So it just worked out perfectly. I lived the idyllic romantic life of a guy with a bunch of puppies in the Alps.
I know Garmisch well. We were assigned to Stuttgart. So oh yeah, it's great. Stuttgart is a great site, but Garmisch, I mean, the Edelweiss and that whole area is amazing. So that must've been fun. Your German friends, it must've been saying juice goodbye.
They were definitely sweethearts about it. And I know I just hung out with puppies and got
Oh, well, that sounds like a good story. But I got to say that, you know, there is some humor. It's the soldier humor that's peppered throughout the film. I mean, Orlando Bloom, when he taps on, you know, I think you're in the talk and everybody's gathered around and everybody's talking really loud and he starts tapping his bars on his arm, you know, the his patch. And he says, hello, is this working? I just thought that is so funny.
Ben Keating actually used to do that. Yeah, that's something. Most of the stuff that's done, that's where we were adapting and changing things. Rod would be talking to the families all the time, and then he would come the next day, and we would add things or add nuances and stuff that people would do. So like the tapping of the, right, of the rank to make a microphone, that was all real. It's pretty amazing. Even Liebert. He talked about Liebert and the stuffed animal, the little dog that was on Liebert's bed. That was real. When they first came in, they mentioned Liebert and they were like, what is this? And there was a stuffed animal. There was really a stuffed animal on Liebert's bed.
So this question is for both of you. What did you find the most difficult part about making this movie? I know that it's honoring the soldiers and making sure that you were true for the families, the Gold Star families. But what do you think that was for you, Hank?
I feel like I was sort of a parrot on Rod's shoulder that he allowed to be there. I think he wanted me there to sort of guide in certain ways because of I had sort of tapped into the experience. And I always thought that this story was so perfect because it kind of gets at the heart of the war in Afghanistan. It strikes at a question of like, was our strategy correct? Was there a futility in all of this? And without sort of getting unnecessarily critical or political about it. And so I think that for me, when I think about what I was really trying to impress upon Rod, was trying to sort of walk this line of being able to tell the story of the war itself and the story of these guys. I think a lot of other war movies have not done so well. You said earlier that the film is kind of apolitical, and that's somewhat true, but it really also speaks to the futility of that base and somewhat to the futility of our mission in Afghanistan. And I don't mean to say that it was a complete waste of time. I just think that it was sort of misguided in certain ways. And so I think that getting that sort of tone where you are able to sort of speak to the honor that took place there, whether it was by us or Afghans or whoever, without it becoming some sort of lesson to the audience about what's going on, or even inversely, which I think would be worse, some sort of mythologizing of like the American hero in a way that without having a self-awareness of what was happening there.
Yeah. No, I think I agree with you on that. And I think that's the key is that, you know, I mean, there were mentions of McChrystal and, you know, there was a little peppering of a little bit of, you know, the reasons why I heard it. but beyond all that, this was really, I think it, you guys really concentrated on the lives that were lost there. And, you know, because, you know, I mean, I know it's, you know, it's trite, but true, the cost of freedom. And I think, when you think about the fact that recruiting goals and where it comes from, it's the heartland of America. I mean, it comes from every walk of life. And the servicemen and women who decide to go up and, you know, raise their hand and take that oath. And yeah, but there's all kinds of reasons, you know. I mean, it's like...
Yeah, but you still do it.
And they still do it. Right, exactly. You still go through it and you still serve. And nobody wanted to go to Vietnam. My dad was a Vietnam vet, but he went anyway, you know, and he did his time and he served and he lost and he never spoke about the war again. And that you'll find on a lot of veterans. I have, you know, over the years, not only with Homefront Girl, but, you know, throughout my life, I mean, I've been involved with a lot of charities and I've dealt with a lot of friends who were taking care of their loved ones who came back with TBI and PTSD and all kinds of other visible wounds. And you know, it's never an easy thing to watch and to see the hurt and the pain. I served as an Arlington lady at Arlington Cemetery, an Army Arlington lady, and I was there at the presenting of the flag for many families. And, you know, I don't think there's a moment more poignant than when you have to walk up to that family member and look into their eyes and tell them, you know, at the point when I was doing it, I would say, I am an Army wife. Because I wanted them to know that I wasn't just there with all the pomp and circumstance of Arlington, you know, and Pershing's, you know, full honors. I wanted them to know that I could be me sitting in that chair, that we have this bond. And I think that's the bond that soldiers have in the field and when they decide to serve. And I know that this film was screened first to the families of the soldiers. When did you do that, Jonathan? When did that happen?
We did that in December of, it was December of 2019. December of 2019. It was at the Army Navy Theater. Oh, no, sorry, not the Army, the Navy Theater. I don't think that there is an Army Navy Theater.
Oh, okay, I thought you meant the Army Navy Club, but okay.
The Army Navy Club, but I think the Navy Theater, that was what was available. And we were, man, that was nerve-wracking. That was the first night I met John Hill in person.
Wow.
You know, Stoney Portis was there, Chris Cordova was there. And those were guys that we had gotten kind of, you know, pretty close to because they had come to visit us on the set. So I remember when everyone ushered into the theater, I was kind of just standing outside. I was kind of freaking out. And I don't remember if it was Stoney or Chris. It was like, hey, Yoni, come here. And like they pull out a bottle of whiskey. And I was like, thanks.
Like with courage.
Yeah. And but all, you know, a couple people walked out, not because they didn't like it, but because it was hard to watch. But for the most part, everybody really liked the movie and thought that it was a pretty accurate portrayal of what went on over there. And that was for us the validation that we really cared most about, was the validation of the families.
The Gold Star families especially.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, and then as far, you had asked before about what was hard about, when you meant what was hard, what was the challenges about making the movie?
I think it was a personal, for yourself personally. I think the challenge of making the movie, I guess I'm more interested in you personally in doing the film. What did you find the hardest?
It was just, one, making a movie like this and running a company at the same time is very difficult. So, but I gave, my partner really stepped in for me and he let me go away and do the outpost and focus only on the outpost. Which was,
how long did the filming take?
Filming was 39 days. But we had put the push because, I don't know, you don't know this, or maybe you do know this, but Scott Eastwood did like half the movie with a broken ankle.
No, I did not know that.
Yeah, he did. And that was something we had to deal with.
You what? Huh? What did you say?
I broke it? Couldn't stand the
yeah, Hank broke.
That sounded like a dirty, hairy comment there.
I broke.
Okay. Why'd you do that to Scott? He's so cute. Come on, be nice.
He broke running, I think.
because pain is weakness leaving the body.
Pain is weakness. Wait, is that a Marine saying or an Army saying? I think that's a Marine.
I have no idea.
We
ran into a lot of emotional obstacles. You know, obviously Rod's son had passed away a month before we started filming, and he, once that happened, you know, and may Hunter rest in peace and the movie's dedicated to him, but once that happened, anything else that happened after that, we were like, we're still making the movie. Like nothing else can happen that's going to make a step that's worse than this. So we heard Scott broke his ankle. He couldn't walk. We don't care. Bring him out anyway. Like anything that happened. We had to get our budget cut. We had to get this happen. Like that was a big challenge. And the emotional toll, I started to just get so emotionally invested. I get invested in all of my movies.
Yeah.
But I'm so invested in The Outpost. And so it would be hard to make decisions as an executive, as it were, as a creative producer, or as an actor, because sometimes you have to make decisions as an executive that can piss off a creative producer.
You had three hats that you were wearing.
So there was all these, but that was just some, but you know, it all balanced out at the end.
Yes, it certainly did. I mean, you did, like I said, I mean, it's just extraordinary. I mean, as a family member, as a daughter of a combat vet, and, you know, I think the one thing that I will honestly tell you that I feel, and I'm not speaking for the families, but I think that what you did in portraying and giving an insight to their lives before the battle, that was a sense of honoring them deeply that I think they can take with them. It must have been harrowing for them to witness their deaths on a screen. I mean, that goes without saying that it's just a horror. But the valor and just the what their lives would have been like prior to this battle and prior to losing their lives, I think we all grew to love every single one of them. Or I should say we. I did. I totally was invested in those eight men and women or men who lost their lives. And I think that is something that I think you should definitely be extraordinarily proud of, Jonathan, because you were dogged about getting this film and you got it. So, Rod Lurie as director, I mean, he brought his military background to it and his respect for soldiers and the fact that you all respected so much what the Gold Star families would think was important. So I think your heart was in the right place all around. And for the followers of Homefront Girl and, you know, all the ones that have written me, and I've said that I was going to be interviewing some of the producers and members of the cast of, I didn't give names, but they were all excited because they've seen the film. The one thing I will tell you, Jonathan, which might be something that you might really, it might make you feel kind of good. What I've heard from a lot of these is that they went in really afraid that they were going to watch another Saving Private Ryan, you know, which is an excellent, amazing film, taking nothing away from that film. But it was so viscerally, you know, gory, the reality of the landings on Normandy. I mean, so, you know, for a lot of people, especially families who are military, you know, going in and watching some of these films, it's, you really don't want to watch a lot of that. This film didn't have that, even during the battle. I mean, it was a scene with that once, I don't know, I think that was the first soldier, but he got hit in the face. So you see a little of that, but there wasn't really any of the, you know, blood and gore. But you knew this was a battle that was going on. So
there was some of it. There was some of it. And that's one of the reasons that we didn't want to show that much. It's because we knew that they would be seeing this. And to be honest, I don't think it's necessary.
It isn't necessary.
I don't think in filmmaking to show something like that is necessary. One, a person's, I think in filmmaking, the less you show, you know, a person's imagination is unique to themselves. They can make it up in their mind how they want. But I just think that showing a lot of the gore would just been really unnecessary and not tasteful for this movie.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. Okay, guys, you know, I want to thank you both for joining me tonight. I mean, it's been such an honor and a pleasure. Hank, we'll do the salute later, whatever the handshake. It was great to meet you. Much continued success on everything that you're doing. And Jonathan, the same to you. I mean, it's been a real honor to have had the chance to speak with both of you about a film that I think is going to be definitely, it is a tour de force. And but one of the things I want to do before I say goodbye and end this is I really would like to do a roll call of the men and women who were killed in this battle. So I will start with Justin T. Gallegos. He was from Tucson, Arizona. Christopher Griffin from Kinilo, Michigan. Kevin C. Thompson of Reno, Nevada. Michael P. Scusa of Villas, New Jersey, Vernon W. Martin, and he was from Savannah, Georgia. Stephen L. Mace, Lovettsville, Virginia. Joshua J. Kirk, South Portland, Maine. And Joshua M. Hart from Applegate, California. I want to give a heart salute to all our Gold Star families, and especially those of these eight men who lost their lives protecting our freedoms and, you know, just following through and doing what they took an oath to do, which was to fight the battles that our country sends them out to do. So I want to thank you both for joining me tonight. I have encouraged everyone I know, both military and those who are not, to see this film. It's an incredible tribute to just the regular soldier who has boots on the ground and gives his all to his country and his fellow brothers and sisters in arms. So congratulations, gentlemen, for being a part of an extraordinary film.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having us, Gabby.
Oh, absolutely.
Thank you very much.
Oh, well, you're very welcome. All right, it was a pleasure.
I'll see you Thursday.
Yeah, you guys see each other on Thursday. Have a good time and be safe. Stay healthy.
Thank you.
You too.
Absolutely.
Okay, bye-bye.
Oh, and, Gabby, can you do me a favor? Sorry. Can you send me the piece with a video of when I showed you the picture of John Hill?
Absolutely.
Just so you can isolate that. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. I'll send it to you. So you guys have a good evening and stay safe. And thank you again for being on Homefront Girl, the podcast.
Of course. Thank you, Gabby.
Bye-bye. Yeah.